attend our Professor Gundlach's Lawyers Ethics class on the 12th of November 2008, podcast number 2 in Roosevelt 109.
Yeah. All of the part-time music, yes. Yes. I thought you said he was going to do only 4L.
Like, I'll give you an example. At 12:02, three trials go, 3L, over.
I'm actually going to see if I can create another section of that. I've already got, I'm trying to figure out if we can offer another class of that.
But there's other classes, the same scenario. So, yeah. Big time classes.
All right, give me some of the day classes that got filled really fast.
Negotiation seminars.
One at a time, please.
Negotiation
right.
Seminar with Bush.
Uh-huh. Family law. What? All right, I've heard negotiation family law. Pre-trial skills, we need another one. You're not going to get another one of that, but okay, good. ADR. We've got several drafting classes. But then there's also transactional, which is another option. There's three sections of transactional. They're at the same time? We have three different transactional courses. They're not offered at the same time.
So you can pick one or the other.
Right. Okay. Whoa! Okay, hold on. What? Oh, you're right. Thank you. Would you like to teach the anybody?
I need the advanced class. I took the first session.
I know there's one.
Which bar class? The keeper class?
Yeah, we have to get approval to register.
That's right, because there is a group of students who are automatically enrolled in that class because we want to preserve them the right to make the class first. If any of them drop it, then we open it up. We realize that it's not an ideal situation because it means that not everybody gets to take the class. Part of the issue is in the past, up until this year, the ABA didn't allow us to offer those kinds of courses for credit towards graduation and towards making management. So a lot of law schools didn't even offer these kinds of courses. If I can show you the enrollment numbers from last year, they weren't all that big. So the keeper is going to agree to offer these two sections, so we're limited to that. All I can tell you is it's basically kind of survey course. Certainly not any kind of course that you should take instead of other bar-tech courses or anything like that. You can have that, but it's not ideal. I'm just telling you, it's because of your time, and they just would have changed the ABA standards this year. So, in the future, hopefully, they'll talk about the ABA standards. And again, there are caps on it because of the ABA standards.
Why can we start looking at the ABA standards about contacting Ryan Castor?
Yeah, contact Hillary Burgess. That's pretty much it. And then she'll make a determination of that. She's basically the instructor for the whole now. So she would then notify Ryan Castor if she's determining that you can join the course. Okay. But again, I may not guarantee you can get a spot.
I would say that the problem is that they're changing on slash pay.
We have an email that has to get confirmation from the professor. So, and I definitely said to Brian, every time I email him, I have that professor on board, and I say, send it out to the email. So, some of it is the lag time that it takes for me to actually go out and find the person who's teaching, and get the agreement, and get the final spot, and all that stuff. Yeah.
Is there a way to switch to either at the mall or the taxation? They're offered at the same time, just a 1 hour course in the class. Just 2 hours
long. Right, and that's what happens with the blocks. Yeah. That's a good question. So within the same 2 hour block, just moving it to the other hour?
Yeah.
Admin and corporate. Question is what impact that will have on everybody else. Alright, let me check on it. Yep. So, let me give an example. So, during a certain time slot on Tuesday. Again, I'll explain to you, it's not ideal, and I'll see if we can do any further shifting in it. Because, again, a lot of our adjuncts are also going to get on the tower to take the teaching. A lot of our adjuncts teach as well. So, they're saying, I want to teach on Tuesday for a 2 hour time slot. A lot of them came in saying Tuesday, for example. And we did the best we could to try and shift them off of that, but for some reason, all of them So, let me see if there's any more in the room for that.
Okay.
Okay.
you're writing ones.
Right.
if you are going to have a really broad definition of what happens to law, then it prevents us from filling in gaps by using non-lawyers. And if you saw in the Bates case, that was a perfect example of the kind of unbundled legal services or very, very simple legal services that could be offered. And we very well might get into a realm where we have to start providing those kinds of very simple unbundled legal services provided by non-lawyers. We're going to be able to make any kind of dent and torture people in the search. I've been working on all of these foreclosure initiatives in the five boroughs in New York City and trying to Society Institute and a number of other foreclosure cases. 95% of people who borrowers who are facing foreclosure don't represent. 95%. And there are something like 100,000 cases filed over the years. So imagine judges who are having to deal with all of the number of people who are going to represent. That's very difficult. And a lot of them have legitimate objections, jurisdictional objections. So that alone is one substantive area. So could it be possible, if we envision what they just created now, a mandatory settlement conference, we have to go through the borrower and the mortgage lender, and now could we possibly envision the notion of law students, of paralegals, of people who are trained to at least just go and represent them in a minimal way. You oftentimes need to negotiate with them right then and there. So that's one example.
I guess I would like to try to understand, I guess, the expectation or unreasonable expectation of having total practitioners for small firms having the time to be able to walk away with that.
Talking about that afterwards, and that's something that we kind of looking for. There's always been discussions for All right, so I'm going to pick up quickly from the end of last week and then we'll get into the new material. Okay, so if you remember last week, right at the end, we started, I said we would talk about this really briefly. Again, this is on your front page, so you can look at it more carefully. I'm going to kind of fly through it. I'm flagging it only as viewing this as another exception that you have to think about with respect to 1.6 as a confidentiality rule. 4.1 concerns the responsibilities that are owed by a lawyer in making statements to third parties, to third persons. So this is not candor to the tribunal under 3.3. This is oftentimes comes into the realm of opposing parties or opposing counsel. And the rule says, the rest of it, in the course of representing a client, a lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of material fact or law to a third person, or fail to disclose a material fact to a third person when disclosure is necessary to avoid assisting a criminal or fraudulent act by a client, unless disclosure is prohibited by Rule 1.6. So, really inartfully worded is this new little piece that was a recent amendment, as you saw in your book. The problem is that the way Rule 1.6 reads is what? It says you may disclose, not you must disclose. So, unless something is prohibited by Rule 1.6, so you're basically, if you're in the realm of any of the exceptional situations under paragraph B of Rule 1.6, then you've got an automatic disclosure that's going to basically set up under 4.1. No way you're going to be able to read that from where you are, so I encourage you to look at it on Twin. This is what I kind of created, which is a trilemma cheat sheet, which kind of looks at these three components of Rule 1.6, 4.1, and 3.3. And I talk about what each of these rules prohibits, and then situations that require some kind of remedial measure or disclosure under the rules. And I include, again, the provisions under all three. And then the limits for both. So, as we talked about with 3.3, there are certain kinds of limits with respect to disclosure, like, for example, only until the proceedings have ended. So, once final judgment has been affirmed on appeal or time for review has passed, you're done and you no longer have a disclosure requirement. It also only arises in the context of adjudicative proceedings. If you are not before a tribunal, then 3.3 isn't implicated, which is one of the reasons why the drafters of the rule felt we also needed this piece of it to go along with it. This I've also talked about, the limits of the rule in negotiations, for example. One exception that's routinely recognized is that certain kinds of puffing about price values, settlement offers, undisclosed principal, and that kind of thing, that tend to be viewed as fair game in negotiations are not going to be viewed as violating 4.1. There's also, again, except as provided no affirmative duty to inform the opposing party of relevant facts. So this is not a kind of an absolute rule. There are some ways that you can fall into scenarios where you don't actually have a disclosure requirement. You can look at these more carefully online, but I wanted to at least flag it for you. You know, it's not, the trilemma situation is not something that comes up all that often, but I want to use, again, they kind of test for it on the FPRE more than anything, so I wanted to keep it. Okay. Again, and also, what? I know. It was on Twin last week. All right, hold on a second. Heiko, what was the most bizarre question you saw, by the way? I am so glad that you are amusing me today because I really need it. Good.
I was serious.
I know, I'm sure you are.
I'm focusing on the MPRE. Okay, it's really dumb.
What?
Okay. Going on to our conflict material for today. I'm going to spend some time, probably up until we break around 3, just kind of giving you a lay of the land of conflict. Okay. As you saw in your book, you got a little bit of a smattering of an overview of all the relevant rules dealing with conflicts. And we're starting off with the ones that deal with concurrent conflicts between either yourself and the client or between two clients. And 1.7 is kind of the starter rule for all of these. And what I'm going to walk you through by the end of today, and we're going to apply it to the problems that we're going to work on, is an analysis I'm going to keep having you hit on it over and over and over again because it's a really helpful way for us to walk through applying these rules. Okay, so under paragraph A, a lawyer is prohibited from representing a client if the representation involves a concurrent conflict of interest and then it defines that kind of conflict. Okay? So one is where the representation would be directly adverse to another client. Okay, we're going to talk about what some of these underlying terms mean. But one is direct adversity. That's one kind of a conflict situation under 1.7. The second is if you've got a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client, a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer. The personal interest of the lawyer is basically saying if you've got a conflict under 1.8, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. Former clients are dealt with under Rule 1.9, but the responsibilities to another client is really what we're in the realm with respect to concurrent clients. Okay? So, two kinds of conflicts that are impermissible. One is direct adversity, the other is where there's going to be a significant risk that you're representation is going to be materially limited in some way. Okay? We then go into paragraph B. So that just sets up the definition of conflict. We can go ahead and continue the representation despite the existence of either of these kinds of conflicts if, one, we have a reasonable belief that we'll be able to provide competent and diligent representation to each client. Two, the representation isn't prohibited by law, which is rarely, if ever, raised. Three, the representation doesn't involve an assertion of a claim by one client against another in the same litigation or other proceedings or a tribunal. And each client gives informed written consent. All four of these factors have to be met in order for you to go ahead and proceed with representation, despite the fact that you've got one of these kinds of conflicts, okay? So if you're facing a conflict situation, the first thing that you're going to do is think about, am I in one of these two situations? And if I am, are all of these factors met such that I could go ahead and proceed with the representation? Okay? And we're going to talk more about that analysis when we start to talk about the problem. So again, while the requirements of 1.7b are not met, the result is it's viewed as an unconsensible or non-consensible conflict, and the lawyer cannot continue with representation. End of story. Something that a lot of lawyers, as well as law students in ethics classes and who are taking the MPRE, get a little confused about is they sometimes mix up Rule 1.7 or 1.7 with 1.9, which deals with former clients. And there are certain situations where you don't necessarily need the consent to be able to proceed. Under 1.7, if you haven't met those four factors, it is an unconsensible client conflict and you cannot proceed, period. Okay? Also, I note that there's no intent or mens rea requirement in Rule 1.7. In other words, again, if you've got this unconsensible conflict, you've got to decline to take the case, withdraw, or risk discipline. Ignorance is no defense. So you have to be hawkishly looking out for these kinds of conflicts. It's why most firms in the country, if not all, have some form of a conflict system in place to be able to look out for these. All right, so then we get into some of these kinds of terms that we find in 1.7. The first one being, what type of conflicts are directly adverse? One example I give is, the lawyer can't represent client number one against client number two, and then represent client two in some other unrelated matter. So, you have one client versus another client, and then you have some separate matter on the side. Another one, you can't cross-examine your client who appears as a witness in another client's lawsuit. These are all just coming from transactional matters. Don't forget, we're not only focused on litigation-based cases. In transactional matters, oftentimes this can come up when the lawyer is representing a seller in negotiations with a buyer, or the lawyer is representing the buyer in some unrelated other matter. That happens oftentimes in types of conflicts that are not directly adverse. And some of this comes out of the comments that you see to Rule 1.7. This is yet another series of rules where the comments themselves are pretty needy in helping you work your way through them. Simultaneous representation in unrelated matters of clients whose interests are only economically adverse, for example, competing enterprises, does not ordinarily constitute a conflict that's directly adverse. I was actually having lunch with a former managing partner of Cohen & Bankman, who's now general counsel for a big energy company, yesterday, and he was talking about how he routinely sees this, and it's not a big deal. So he's on the client side of it in getting requests from law firms to sign conflict waivers against other kinds of situations. And he says, you know, routinely the economic adversity issue doesn't really bother him. It's not something, unless there's something really, really unique to whatever the industry is. Lawyers can also take inconsistent legal positions in different tribunals at different times on behalf of different kinds of clients. So in general, you can take different legal positions. Your clients may not like it, but it doesn't necessarily rise to the level of a violation under 1.7. Unless, and I'm underlining unless, the precedent could be viewed as seriously weakening your client's position. Especially if they are in the same jurisdiction. That's where you're really going to have the firecrackers go off. And then finally, simultaneous representation in the same matter, or joint representation, which hopefully we'll get to this in the next class. Again, maybe okay unless there's some kind of a substantial discrepancy in the client's testimony, the clients have incompatible positions in relation to the opposing parties, or they have substantially different possibilities for settlement. And those are all factors that need to be considered when you're advising clients about whether or not to enter into a joint representation situation. When is representation going to be materially limited? This is a phrase that we've heard routinely throughout the rule. The critical questions I want you to think about are things like, what's the likelihood that the interests are going to divide? Are they already divided? Could they divide in the future? Is there, you know, try and thinking about the different kinds of scenarios and how things are going to play out in your representation of the client. Will the divided interests affect the lawyer's ability to judge and consider alternatives? Sometimes those divided interests won't be all that material. What kind of function is the lawyer performing? What is the legal service that's being offered? Is it a negotiation? Is it people creating a partnership? Is it a deal of some kind? Is it litigation? Are they both joint defendants against something? Is it a criminal proceeding? There's a lot of different kinds of factors you can think about. Will the divided interests foreclose courses of action that reasonably should be pursued on behalf of the client? So in other words, if you take both of them, are there going to be certain situations where you're going to have to say to them, if X results from this, I'm going to have to withdraw from both of you if we get to this certain kind of hearing to talk about that. So again, comment 8 to Rule 1.7 is what talks through a number of those kinds of situations. Personal interest. In Rule 1.7, as I said when we first looked at the first slide, this notion of personal interest is a reference to Rule 1.8. And there are a long series of sub-paragraphs in Rule 1.8 that talk about all the different possible personal interest scenarios that can create conflicts for lawyers. And some of them are things like the conduct and the transaction is in serious question, the lawyer has been approached by the client's opposing party for employment or retention, the lawyer refers the client to an enterprise in which the lawyer has some undisclosed financial interest. That happens with relative frequency. Lawyers related by blood or marriage to another lawyer, sexual relations with the client, and that predates the formation of the relationship. So again, these are all within Rule 1.8. And then, this is again what I want to point out. Comment 2 to Rule 1.7 lays out a great methodology for working through your conflicts of interest problems. One, first thing we talked about at the beginning of the semester, identify the client. Who are they? Who is being represented by what lawyer? And oftentimes what I will have you do as you go through these problems is literally chart them out, especially for those of you who are more visually inclined. It's a great way for you to actually see potential conflicts and relationships. Second, determine whether a conflict exists. Remember again, paragraph A, look and see whether you're in one of those two situations that are considered to be conflicts. Three, decide whether the conflict is consensible. So kick into paragraph B of 1.7 and determine whether or not those four factors are in place. And if so, if all of them are, then you need to then consult the client and obtain informed written consent. Do not forget that this is the last essential step. There are a lot of lawyers who go through these first three, and then they just kind of think that they've gotten the client's consent. I place the emphasis on informed written consent. Why is this moved? It's not always in every jurisdiction required that it be written. It's always required in some sense that it's informed consent. If you see Rule 1.0e, which is the definition section of the model book, it tells you that informed consent requires that the lawyer provide adequate information and explanation about the risks of and the reasonable available alternatives to the proposed course of action. Most law firms these days literally have the written consent form in place, and they'll plug in that language into whatever document they're sending to the client after they've And ideally, you go through that when you're meeting with the client and you're discussing the intentions of the case. You're then going to have the client sign it. You're going to follow up with a letter saying, yes, they are in fact representing you. You're going to include this consent and a copy of it for the client and talk about all the things that you discussed and all the advice that you gave to them about whether or not to agree to the consent. If you do all of that, most of the time, you're going to be in good shape, unless you have some renegade set of facts or a renegade lawyer who's just really not happy with the situation. You're probably going to be able to withstand any kind of emotion for disqualification. When multiple representations are an issue, the client's got to be told of the implications of the common representation. Impact of things like loyalty, confidentiality, privilege, advantages, the risks involved. And again, both clients must agree to permit the necessary disclosure by the lawyer. This is comments 18 and 19 to the rule. Just as far as nomenclature goes, a number of jurisdictions refer to them as waivers rather than consents. They're relatively interchangeable as far as terms go. The model rules talk in form of consents, but a lot of lawyers refer to them as waivers that they get from their clients. Another point about the consultation of another attorney, the client doesn't have to actually go off and consult another attorney for the consent to be viewed as valid. Always a good idea to suggest this, and preferably in writing, to the client. that makes the waiver all that much more ironclad from the court's perspective, because it means you've gone out of your way to say, I've explained all of this to you, but I, you know, wholeheartedly suggest that you go get an independent lawyer to review this and advise you on it before you agree to confess the situation. So then, your view is having taken that additional step to protect the client's interests. And one question that's routinely coming up a lot these days, again, was kind of the basis of a lot of this lunch discussion that I had yesterday with this lawyer, is whether or not lawyers should be permitted to ask clients to waive future conflicts, and whether or not we should allow for those kind of waivers to stand. And attorneys are increasingly fighting on those grounds. Actually, clients have been hiring attorneys to fight on these grounds. Routinely, when people are hiring lawyers, they're being asked nowadays, especially at big firms that have multiple offices and sizable firms, to ask their clients to sign these kinds of advance waivers. And even more difficult is sometimes there are what's called advance blanket waivers, where they're not even describing the actual conflict that's even apparent right now, but just saying you're going to waive all future conflicts of whatever kind of nature comes down the pipe. And really the effectiveness is going to depend on the extent to which the client reasonably understands the material risks that the waiver entails and the extent of the lawyer's explanation. What's also going to be taken into account is the client. Again, as we talked about with respect to fees, for example, the client's identity will inevitably be considered. Is this somebody who is a seasoned lawyer who happens to be general counsel of the firm that is the client? Or is it some, you know, little lady who's being asked to sign it? Advanced waivers are generally going to be acceptable if the attorney makes all the appropriate disclosures, the client possesses the necessary sophistication, and the client is then consulting with independent counsel. The blanket advance waivers are not, there's not an automatic ban on them, but again, as I said, courts are increasingly starting to disregard them and not honor them, because it's too difficult, even for sophisticated clients, to be able to look way down the road and anticipate any and all conflicts that are going to come down and make any kind of an informed waiver of that. Okay. A couple other things I just want to talk through quickly. I'm not going to go through Rule 1.8. I have it up there more in case you want to reference it during the problem. You should make yourself familiar with all the exceptions that are, with all the situations that are prohibited in Rule 1.8, just as far as a topical knowledge more than anything. My intent here is for you only to be able to spot the issue and then actually go to Rule 1.8 and see what it actually says about this. There's a lot of them to be covered, and I'd rather focus on the bigger analysis under 1.7. So again, if you see something, for example, dealing with, you know, whether or not you're allowed to have sex with your client, okay, you should know, all right, there's actually something in 1.8 that says something about that, and I'm going to go look at it. Okay, that's the kind of knowledge that I want you to have with respect to 1.8. And the only other one that we're going to talk about today is Rule 1.10, which deals with imputed conflicts. And we're only going to deal with one piece of it. We're going to save the stuff that deals with former clients for next week. But the rule talks about how when a member of a firm is disqualified from representing a client, the lawyer's conflict is generally imputed to the rest of the firm. The theory here is that there's just too much of a temptation for that lawyer who has the conflict herself to go ahead and share that with her colleague. So we're literally just not going to permit it, period, when they're both members of the firm. The model rules take a really hard stance on this, and a number of jurisdictions across the country allow for, I'm sure you've heard, some kind of screening measures that can be taken place to screen out the lawyer from working on the case or from disclosing this kind of information or having the information disclosed to him. The model rules do not find screening to be an acceptable alternative. Okay. So, let's go into the application of these rules to some of the problems that we have today. Not with respect to the concurrent rank. Yeah, they take a really hard view. They do not like the screen. At least you check the private traffic source. Okay. Let's go to the problem on page 190 and 91, made the lawyer PR point. We have time if there's a great clip from Boston Legal that we're trying to show some of the medical business. How about Alvin? And maybe you can just again remind us and set us up for what's an issue with this problem before you get started on how they do it. Here, the direct adversity would literally be here to here. inspired Alvin. What's the best argument you could make for some kind of a significant interest in material relations? Alvin was focusing, understandably so, on, well, Bella wasn't really involved in this malpractice situation, so how is there really any real conflict that can be raised here?
I think was, if one of the cases, I guess, was worth a lot more money being for Bella's, then since there's just a small, I figured the I think mine is like a pretty small, maybe it's case would be something like that person for Bella's turn to handle. So they'll concentrate less, so they don't want to come to see Bella's and get a new position.
Okay. So there might be just divided loyalty with respect to representing the plaintiff in this case and the defendant in this case. Even though they're not the same proceedings, they're still on the other, the firm itself, Bello representing the firm, is on the other side of this other case. And so there's a concern maybe that it's a tray of hot potato, they're going to drop it like a hot potato because maybe this is a more valuable case. Okay, so that might be, how would you articulate that as a rule, that the significant risk of material limitation of the lawyer?
It's, I mean,
it's going
to prevent them from doing, if they would concentrate all their efforts on being able to advance all the company, they have to pull back a little bit, and concentrate more of that time, all these things, I guess.
Because of what? Why would they do that?
So, I guess, the more value of doing the trial.
Right, money, financial interest of the lawyer, right, or business development of the lawyers, of Nola and Jen's firm, right? So, and how would you, does it say really that money is the same word as the significantness of the material limitation can be stemming from the financial interest of the lawyer? How would you articulate that with respect to Rule 1.17? What does it reference? Exactly, under 1.8. This is really a 1.8 issue. This is the business interest or the personal interest, as is phrased in 1.7, of the lawyer. Okay, but we're still missing one step. This is the personal interest of Jen. Right, in Jen's representation against Bello, this other case. Why should she, why is Nola's interest due to
1782?
Exactly. So you've got to take into account the imputation of conflict. So the next step that you've got articulated saying, here's the significant risk of material limitation with respect to the personal interests of the lawyers under 1.8. And if Nola has this issue, then Jen has this issue, and vice versa. They're imputed under 1.1 because they're both lawyers in the same firm. So that's how the analysis would go. Do you want to push back a little bit? Okay.
Thank you.
if you didn't do this ahead of time, then probably John's motion is qualified as actually is granted. So even long before that motion was qualified, when Nola and Jen are deliberating about whether or not to take this legal malpractice case, they can't just kind of stop here. They've got to actually anticipate this argument. It may not be hugely strong, but there's an argument there, and they need to be able to anticipate it. So anticipating that there might be a conflict out there that could be anticipated, moving into whether or not they're in the realm of a consensual conflict. If they think that they are, and they have that discussion with the client, inform the client about it, etc., then they're probably in good shape. So you want to, again, make sure that you describe all of that. You're going to want to have it in writing. You're going to want to not only tell this client, but you're going to want to tell this client, because this client is going to be also interested. If they later find out and get wind that you're representing fellow attorneys in this criminal practice case, they may not necessarily be happy about it. So it's a good idea to go ahead and talk about it. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and do some more stuff.
But what about the He doesn't give us time. He gives us, like, you know, how many days you have to between, like, you know, like, the certain process, you know, like, this many days to respond. And none of the days are obviously, they're all, like, random days.
Yeah, I can't.
So, client flags the potential legal malpractice. Lawyer's first response is,
think about this. Well, first of all, as you accurately say, determine whether or not that actually has happened, or what the client is saying has actually happened. All right, so realistically, how are you going to do that?
You're going to have to see what he said that we didn't file is. Check to make sure, A, that it wasn't filed, B, that that's the memory, so we hadn't filed, it had been filed.
So you're saying the firm should engage in its own internal investigation. Anybody see the problem, sir? Or do you see the problem, sir? So reflect on that for a minute. Before you propose it to the senior partners of the firm, what's the problem if your firm does its own internal investigation? Yeah, I mean, they could potentially be then acting adversely to the client or have been viewed as acting adversely to the client in some way. So it begins to set up a little bit more of an awkwardness as they engage in this internal investigation. So that could be potentially a problem. What about, is there another alternative to having the firm itself doing the internal investigation? Your malpractice counsel. Every firm has malpractice insurance. You're going to have a lawyer. You could theoretically have do that investigation. What's the problem with them doing it? Well, there might be some problem that they're going ahead and engaging in this internal investigation and having to report to Marginex about it, but then if a lawsuit later develops, they might end up getting conflicted out because they did the internal investigation of the firm. So that may not be the best way. So you really may have to get a completely third-party lawyer to do it, separate from even from your malpractice area. So again, you can think about these multiple layers of conflict. Yeah. Exactly. So that was going to be. So the malpractice carrier, the insurance company, actually represents Marginex. So that probably really would be a direct conflict if you were ultimately having them do the internal investigation. So that would be a direct conflict. So probably the bottom line is you've got to get, you rightfully are saying, if you want to start off with that and do an investigation, but you're going to have to have a wholly disinterested third party do the investigation, another law firm. Okay, so that answers the fact-finding question. Then what do you need to look at? Identified these conflicts, but we think they're dispensable. We go through these four factors, we meet them all.
Yeah. listen, let me take care of this little problem right now. I'm just going to draw. So I remember the FDRE, so they tell you that you just can't get along with your client and you're allowed to do that. So we'll just do that.
Well, part of the problem here is Marginex has said to the lawyer, we want to keep you for the time being. They don't want, because the transaction is going forward. So that very well, the client may be worried that the transaction is going to fall apart, the deal is going to fall apart if they all of a sudden fire this lawyer. So that's one issue. But from the lawyer's perspective, if that's what you're saying, why not just withdraw? It very well may be that the firm would decide that they don't want to risk this and compromise this any further. But again, they're also probably out a lot of money. That's a great question. If you're in a court proceeding of any kind, you do actually have to be so this is a little bit more tricky. I mean, what this is kind of highlighting is this issue of, you know, one, the advanced waiver concern and how you actually talk about it with your client, but also these practicalities, again, of the back investigation that you flag about how you go about things. Karen Horowitz, on page 256 and 260. So I'm going to have Diana and Jenna do this one. In Diana, not surprisingly, based on the position that you have filled in your memo ahead of time, I'm going to have you represent the interests of the firm. And Jenna representing Karen Horowitz. Maybe Jenna, maybe you can share Karen's situation as the set of the problem.
Advocation for the client as a firm means putting the best possible man in the courtroom. And part of that job is to appeal to the jury and the sentiment. And I think that kind of taking a poll of what is your jury going to see when your attorney is up there arguing for your client. And so the jury class, I know this is like really important, from what you wear to how you speak to your mannerisms. So I think as a partner, I'm going to look at my associates and I'm going to say, God bless you. I'm going to say to myself, you know, who is the best man or woman for this job? Why? And kind of lay out the land, look at the factors geographically. What does my jury look like? Are they conservative? Are they liberal? Are they black? Are they white? Are they religious, not religious? Like, I'm going to take all these factors into consideration. So that's my first argument, is that I have a duty as a partner to look out for the client. Also, at the beginning of this book, at the very like first sentence, it says that this book contains rules and regulations for the behavior of lawyers and judges. So while there's regulations against lawyers and judges as to what our behavior is, there is no regulations for what the jury is going to do. And so...
Or what the client
thinks. Or what the client thinks. So I still have to zealously advocate for my client, and I can't put thoughts or reasoning in the jury. And so I have a duty against my client to, I may not stereotype or judge based on religion, the jury may. And I have to look at that again. You know, my client's paying out money, and I really have to look at that. And finally, I guess my last argument would be that that based on sitting down, understanding the demands of the courtroom, and the allegations and the research that was done by the firm, you know, my decision was ethically sound.
Okay. Jenna, before you respond, I want you to be thinking about, could you go so far as to say that there's a conflict of interest if you put Karen Horowitz on as counsel, as trial counsel? What's your reaction?
Well,
bottom line is she says it's ethically sound for us to, for firm to make this decision.
Well, I think that you can look at it as an objective versus being situation. Basically, the lawyers have the authority to determine what are the best needs. So, yes, I agree, they may think that's the best thing, but at the same time, they're excluding or being prejudiced. And she was arguing that, you know, businesses used to justify this type of discrimination, but you can't do that anymore. And so they're just taking that same concept and applying it here. And she feels that the firm has responsibility for her, too. And if they wanted to, they could put her on a trial so they didn't know the client doesn't want her there.
Are you saying that, so you're saying it's the means are discriminatory and therefore do fall within the realm of the ethics rules? Is there something in the rules that you identified that say we're not allowed to discriminate as to the means?
No, I couldn't. Well, I didn't find anything about gender or religion specific. I thought the code was silent on that, so I couldn't find anything on that. But, I mean, I felt that it was a conflict under 7.1, but at the same time, I couldn't 1.7. Yeah, 1.7. But I couldn't see how a court could actually discipline a lawyer for knowingly representing a client, knowing that her religion and gender would limit the representation of the client. It just seems like discrimination.
No.
My first instinct before going to any ethics court
was going to be like the actual other laws because of how clear both gender and religion are protected by and how clear and forthright the partner was in the UK that this is the reason you're not going. So although there may not necessarily be a remedy under the ethics rules, I thought that there would certainly be case under other laws. And the problem though is that the last question that the firm asked was under Mass B, both women and it said that there was that basically if the reason that was the attorney was fired basically because he was Jewish, and the judge said, well, if there's direct evidence that the plaintiff was just drunk because, quote, a New York Jew, if this is in fact what happened, public policy embodied in Section 181 of the U.S. Code clearly requires plaintiffs to provide a remedy and to speak with the lawyer. But it doesn't go into whatever remedy is in public policy.
So the firm might be risking some kind of alternative lawsuit that could be brought by Karen Horowitz against the firm. What you're saying. There might be liability risks there in the realm of employment discrimination or otherwise. Okay, so they'd have to take that into account in their decision making. And interesting whether or not that in itself rises to the level of a material limitation on their ability to represent the client the way that the client wants to be represented, which is to not have Karen Horowitz do the case. Do you have any response with respect to the conflict issue?
Yeah, I think it's not, I mean, it's against my case, but it would be going to Rule 1.10a with the imputation of conflict of interest that if one of my attorneys contacted and none of my attorneys were in the practice, then I should have dropped the case. However, my firm was not discriminatory because I wasn't looking at Ms. Karen as a Jew. The jury was looking at her as a Jew. And I am not racist, so, or wouldn't take it out on her that she's a religious minority. It had nothing to do with it. It had to do with that my firm had to zealously advocate for my client, or our client, and based on that decision, and based on the demographics, and based on my jury consultant's report to me, that is why we chose to take care of the case.
So this is all about litigation strategy.
It's all about litigation strategy
and zealous advocacy.
With her, personally. Now, if the rest of the world, you know, has that sentiment, shame on them, and I think that's horrible, but
the reality of practice, right? Okay. Interestingly enough, I just want to follow up with your point about the imputation. In Rule 1.10, Paragraph A, it only imputes conflicts under 1.7 and 1.9, not under 1.8. So if you impute a personal conflict under 1.8, it's not going to be imputed to other lawyers in the firm. So, I mean, obviously this is a tough dilemma. It doesn't, you know, it's not a kind of a straightforward conflict question, but it really does make you think about whether there can ever be something so inherent to a lawyer that it rises to the level of a material limitation. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It's kind of related, but not directly to the topic. People, I feel like, use the argument for it. So have I for, like, zealous advocacy. Where are we getting that? Is that
it's actually case? Not in the rule. Good point. Where are you getting that framework from? Getting it from the comments. That's exactly right. What's interesting is it used to be in the model code. It actually, so a lot of lawyers refer to this phrase over and over and over again because it came from the actual content of the model code provision. When they revised the model code and made it into the model rules of professional responsibility, it ended up in a comment rather than an actual rule. So it's a great point that maybe too often we're relying on that phrase when in fact it isn't necessarily an ethical mandate in the rules.
What exactly necessary is competent advocacy?
It's a great point. And what does competency really entail? Diana would argue competence entails recognizing the realities of the jury that she's dealing with in the town that she's representing this client in, and what the client's interests are, and what she thinks is going to help the client win the case. Jenna's point would be different and would say, you know, in fact, there's potentially a conflict there, and there's also issues of means and how we go about what means we use to achieve the client's objectives. Whether or not those are appropriate, yeah.
The situation is different. This is like a one-time thing, right? She's a Jew. We're going to the South. Now, let's say, you know, the partners say all the time, well, you know, for this case, we don't want you on because we're worried that you're a Jew and you're a female. And then the next case, they have you're a Jew and you're a female. So this is like an isolated incident. I mean, it might make a difference.
a great point. So I was actually talking with my dad several years ago, who was a trial attorney in Missouri, and he was relaying this story about an African-American associate in his firm who, of her own accord, said what oftentimes they take cases in kind of the Ozarks area of Missouri, and which is, you know, it's not a great area if you're African-American, and there's going to be the same kind of potentials that are raised in this case. And a lot of the judges are pretty obnoxious as well. And so she said, they had this discussion, she kind of flagged it as, well, should I maybe not be doing cases down in that area? And the partners were talking about it with her, and she basically said, you know, at a certain point, though, am I going to be cut out of all practice in a certain realm if I'm never going to be able to go before judges except in St. Louis? Yeah. and so your point is a good one. And actually, I was going to relay to you Karen Horowitz's story and actually the way it ended up. She was removed from the case. The client won a trial. This is a real case. She did well in other matters, advanced. 2 years later, her husband was offered a position at a prestigious research institution in the same county in the South. Karen interviewed with local firms. She was told that although they'd hire her, they wouldn't be able to send her into court on big cases for the same reason that she was taken off of the case in this situation. So basically, she'd be relegated to doing the background work but would never actually be able to be a trial lawyer going into the cases in that county. And how do we justify that result? I mean, you know, I would hope we would all agree that that's the wrong result, and yet there's no clear authority in the rules that prevents us, and actually Diana made a strong case that the rules actually support this choice that the firm would make. And so, yet again, have we highlighted a situation that's not necessarily the right result with respect to the ethical rules. Okay, and speaking of which, that's a great setup for my good buddy Alan Shore from Boston Legal. As I told you, my favorite Alan Shore is, if you remember, you know what, can I ask Bob Roberts to have that interview you have a fan with us?
I'm not.
So I've talked about how Alan Shore on Boston Legal is this character who often is the lawyer who illustrates how it's the morally right result and the ethically wrong result. And here is yet another situation where, and I'm going to set up the video and then we'll pick up with it next week. So did anybody ever see the paint gun episode? In this case, basically what's happened is Denny Crane is, I think I talked about in first class, Denny Crane is this prominent lawyer who happens to be apparently suffering from mad cow disease, who is a little bit quirky, just to put it mildly. And he apparently he was coming out of a subway stop at Park Street in downtown Boston, and there was a ruckus with a homeless person, and Denny Crane happened to have his paint gun on him and shot the homeless man. And the homeless man is now suing Denny Crane. So we'll see what happens. But by the way, he's now basically bringing in, this is a classic strategy, he's bringing in all the top lawyers in his firm, because this guy has come in with his lawyer. So he's bringing in Shirley and Alan Shore and everybody into this meeting. So do you think that how you're going to analyze this from a conflict perspective?
Who the hell are you?
My name is Mark Pierce.
Walker, and I represent my client, Randall Kirk.
We're for a firm one?
Well, actually, I'm a solo practitioner.
Gee, as you can see, I'm not. I work for a firm. Paul Larson in Boston. Dripping with talent. This is Paul Lewis right here beside him. Shirley Schmidt. Heard of them?
Yes.
What's my name?
I'm Denny Crane. I realize you're a powerful man, sir, but that does not give you the right to shoot homeless people.
You shot this man. If I tell you that he first hit me on the head with a rock.
Well, he tossed a stone in your direction, which inadvertently struck you.
Well, I'm not going to pay, sir. So you spend the next 3 years of your life in discovery, trying to push this case to court, at which point I'll call the clerk and send to a friend of mine. I'm friends with lots of judges. Or you can cut your losses now. You might want to think about this. No other lawyer would take the case. The reason they wouldn't take it is because it's a money loser. So we call a dog. Do you like dog cases, Kim?
I'm not intimidated.
Here's what you need to know about the practice of laws. It all comes down to money. I've got it. He doesn't. I'll win. Any cream?
So, okay. I'm not going to show you the rest of it, but basically, not surprisingly, as you saw, Alan Shore, James Spader's character, is sitting there watching this whole proceeding, and it just rubs him the wrong way, despite the fact that Denny is his best friend. And what happens is that he proceeds to come back at the beginning and after the next commercial to say that he is going to represent the homeless man. As you saw, the poor kid, as Denny Crane called him, withdrew and or was fired by the homeless man and was intimidated by Denny Crane, and now James Spader has decided that he is going to represent the homeless man in his lawsuit against Denny Crane, his best friend and law partner. So, I want you to think about how you would analyze this if you wanted to file a motion to disqualify James Spader from representing, because presumably Denny Crane is going to want to have some grunt associate file a motion to disqualify James Spader from representing the homeless man in his lawsuit against him and the firm. So, think about that. We'll start off with that next week. And Brittany and Lauren, I know we didn't get to you guys because we got distracted a lot. So, if you wouldn't mind, since you prepared the material, let's start with you guys right at the beginning of the next class before we get into the new material. Yes.
Remember, I'm not going to be here. I can write for my the memo of this question.
Okay, excellent. There we go. All right. No, the lawsuit is actually being in Denny Crane, but he's going to use the So you have to think about who's the client, what is the department, how cover up the lawyer.
I watched it on Saturday morning before I
I'm
guy for that.
Sure.
There is a deal. One of the violations was the way of running the park. Like, even before that, career he said that he could publish, that he could, when the judge, you know, it's like a public official.
There were tons of problems.
Just the way he hinted at the letting him so I spoke with him.
Yeah, but that's a Denny ethical violation. It's the guy who's saying he'll work on that.
No, I don't. Probably. Yeah.
That's trying to say, okay, fine, I'm going to work with you.
Right.
So I'm following your ranking.
Let me, because we didn't get to a lot of material on the joint
representation.
Yes, you should be responsible for that.
He became a wrestler, like, after his hand, like, you know, they were doing at the end,
uh-huh.
Like, what the kids all did after.
So I'm going to do some.
Hang on, I got to talk to
him. And I'll explain who's on.
Professor Strong.
Oh. Okay.
So
you asked him.
Because he
said that. He said that? You already asked him?
I know.
Some problems are more conducive to it than others. I feel like my life is kind of planned that I want to actually write my own case book with all my problems that are going to be very dear to me by the time I'm at work. And I try to distribute it, and inevitably it's not equal during this course of the semester, but it's I like people to be able to get on their feet and do that as much as they can.
It really helps to be able to bring them.
I know, it does. And I don't
think, yeah, you're sitting
I don't
there
think we have desk. Enough of that in law school, because you do, even if you don't ever want to step foot into a courtroom, you are so on when you are having to talk to a senior partner in your firm about the case that you're working on. And you've got to be able to, and even interviews and, you know, whatever it is, talking to clients, you've got to be able to think on your feet. You've got to be able to incorporate that law really quickly.
There's just there's like a difference in the way, I operate. I don't know other people. When you're sitting down and like someone's talking to you and you're trying to address a problem, then when you're standing up and like...
This room is also horrible for it.
It's terrible.
Horrible.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
It is.
And you know what? It's completely my own fault because I'd never been in this room before. I was in a different room in Roosevelt. The other one. Right. Which was doable. I mean, it's not great either, but it's doable and it has all the tech stuff.
Yeah.
And so I said to Brian, don't worry about me, you know, put everybody else in whatever rooms they want, and I'll go into whatever in Roosevelt. And I didn't know about this room. So.
Well, at least this room is better than some of the other rooms down this hallway. Have you seen them?
I haven't. I don't need a shutter to even. I think you know anybody who's really wealthy who wants to spend money and do law office, that would be great.
For courses again, let me just take a part of it. Can somehow you somehow twist Professor Strong's arm to teach other courses? I know he's only doing half of this next semester. He's phenomenal.
I know. Trust me, I know.
And I told him, I was like, he just kind of gave me a smirk. I was like, what if I talked to, you know, Dean Edlock?
I
went
to do interviewing and counseling, actually. Uh-huh. He's got a clinical background. And he's a whole lot. And he's technically had a full teaching life.
Yeah, he's teaching for a pro term, and then I think he's teaching criminal law, or what?
He was teaching criminal and evidence in the fall.
No, criminal law, that's what I'm doing. In the spring, he's
teaching evidence.
But that's all he's teaching.
That's right.
Yeah, so.
Yeah,
Yeah, he's phenomenal. We're really lucky to get him.
Yeah, he's very, very good. So I was hoping to do something for us. I try to talk him into
keep
it.
Keep trying and let me know if you succeed. I'm happy
well,
to jump in.
Did he tell you?
Yeah, he's like, it's beyond my reach. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll go talk to someone within whose reach.
You know, I would love to have you. So that would be great.
All right, so then I'll go back and tell him.
She said it was okay.
She said it was okay as long as you agreed to it. Thank you.
Software that actually figures that stuff out yet, and it's coming, but the university is going to be hold on all of these software purchases because it's going to take a while. But because of that, we've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and once we get that software in place, then it will automatically find those kind of conflicts and prevent them from happening.
Yeah, because technically none of them are conflicts, you know.
But it will
start
look
one
for that,
and then
so we want, right, we can have it search for that kind of situation. So you can imagine Brian and I have been, you know, literally sleepless in trying to put together
yes.
this course schedule.
So,
and the exams and things. So it's, you know, you try to do your best to anticipate all of those kind of situations,
yeah.
and inevitably there's people who are not thrilled with it.
Well, I guess the registrar would, well, you know, I have one class, let's say, well, a lot of people have a conflict and they're taking it that Friday. Like, why can't I just request to take it that Friday, too, because that's so many things. Like, a rule like that. You know, like, even if they can't catch it. And the secretary told me that they used to have a rule that if you had three or more, you could, copy, you know, one down, but we don't do that anymore because other schools don't do it.
And again, part of it is because of their availability to create the rooms for all of the conflicted. So it may be that room is filled up. There are so many systemic problems with this, and, you know, this is my first semester in dipping my toe into all of this.
Thank you.